Okay, today we will plan to finish up Acts chapter 14. This will finish up Paul's first missionary journey with Barnabas, Paul and Barnabas. And over the last few weeks of covering this, Paul had been to Antioch and got run out by the Jews from Antioch of Antioch of Pisidia here in modern day Turkey, Asia Minor. We want to contrast that and not confuse this Antioch of Pisidia with what's known as Antioch of Syria. That basically was like the home base for all this mission work. A Gentile congregation here at Antioch, the first Gentile congregation, and also this Antioch in Syria being the place where God named his people that was prophesied from Isaiah back 600 years previously. And this is where God gave his people a new name, and it would be named by the mouth of the Lord. And it was and God named it through Paul and Barnabas were the ones that named it. But that's the main Antioch. And plus, this Antioch was the third largest city in the Roman Empire, the second largest city being Alexandria here in Egypt, North Africa area. But anyway, so here Paul and Barnabas went to Antioch of Pisidia. They got run out of there by the Jews, causing all kind of problems, and then went to Iconium, got run out of Iconium, then went to Lystra, and everything seemed to be doing much better there. Now, Paul also performed miracles in Iconium. There was no mention of any miracles being performed at Antioch, but he performed miracles at Iconium. It's not told to us. Luke didn't record what they were. But then went down to Lystra, and there was a man that was disabled. I'm going to assume he was paralyzed, whatever. He never walked from birth. And the whole town, of course, knew about this man. And Paul healed him, and he immediately stood up and walked and was able to walk and move around for the first time in his life. So then the bad thing that came about that was, here this was a very pagan city. Well, they started calling Paul and Barnabas gods and worshiping them as gods. And as soon as Paul realized that, he and Barnabas tried to shut that down, and they did everything they could to stop that. But and let me see the wording that Luke wrote was scarcely that Paul and Barnabas could scarcely restrain the multitudes from sacrificing to them. So then the Jews came down from Iconium and Antioch and came to Lystra, and the scene turned from that of wanting to make a sacrifice and worship Paul and Barnabas as Greek gods, and it turned on a dime, and the Jews convinced them to stone Paul to death. And so that's exactly what they did. So they went after they saw him, Paul, heal this man, and through God, of course, and enabled this man to walk for the first time in his life. Then they want to worship Paul and Barnabas as Greek gods and have a sacrificial an altar and a sacrifice to them. Paul was able to back them off and stop them from that. And then the Jews came down and then convinced the crowd, instead of sacrificing to them as gods, let's just stone him to death. And so do, or they thought they did. And so they stone Paul at Lystra, and they think he's dead. But fortunately, he was not. He was definitely unconscious and probably very likely in a coma. But anyway, the pagan Gentiles there thought that he was dead. And so then they drug him out of the city outside of the gates of Lystra and left him for dead. And they were just going to leave him, let the whatever wild animals, scavengers, whatever, eat his body. That's what they had left for him. But then there were already the Christians here through Paul and Barnabas's teachings, and they gathered around Paul's body. And by the grace of God, unfortunately, then Paul regained consciousness, and then it thrilled the whole group there that he was able to sit up, and he got up. So then Paul and Barnabas went back into Lystra and stayed the night there. And then the next day they went to Derbe. And then Derbe is the end of the line of this first missionary journey. And so from here, they're going to backtrack back through Lystra, where he was stoned, what they had thought was stoned to death, and then Iconium and Antioch, and then they're going to go back to Perga, and then go to another port city, Italia, and then catch a boat and get back to Antioch. But and the purpose of going back through these towns is to appoint elders. And so that's what Paul and Barnabas do on the way back. And that's exactly where we're picking up today in Acts 14, verse 23. So when they had appointed elders in every church, every congregation, and prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord in whom they had believed. And so, and this is talking about the cities of Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch and Pisidia. And so then Kaufman said about this verse, and he's going to talk about elders. He has two pages written about this. This is the first mention of appointing elders in the New Testament, and a fundamental truth of there being a plurality of elders in each congregation is evident from the very first. This appointment of more than one elder is a scriptural example throughout the New Testament. There may be various reasons for this plurality, but the most obvious one is to avoid a one-man rule in the Lord's body. In light of the fact that an elder cannot be a novice from 1 Timothy 3:6, some question how Paul could appoint elders in every congregation when they had only been Christians for a few years. If anyone is surprised that men were found in these congregations who possessed the high qualifications for the office laid down by Paul in his epistles to Titus and Timothy, we should remember that although these men had been Christians only a comparatively short time, many of them were, in character and knowledge of the Scriptures, the ripest fruits of the Jewish synagogue, and they needed only the additional knowledge which the gospel brought in order to be models of wisdom and devoutness for the congregations. So, even though these men had just been Christians for a few years, they were not novices as in just coming out of sin and paganism. These were not the ones that he chose to be the elders. There very likely were some that had just come out of the paganism. In fact, Paul tells when he writes to the congregation in Corinth in 1 and 2 Corinthians that, he has that whole famous list, a whole paragraph of all kinds of debaucherous sins. And then he finished up at the end of that, and such were some of you. But that was not any of these that he appointed elders. They were very much like the ones that came to Pentecost in Acts chapter 2 that Luke called the devout Jews. And they were fully informed on and educated of the Old Testament. And remember, he was teaching people right out of the Jewish synagogues in all these cities. That was the first place. And this was always Paul's pattern. When he went to a new town, the first place he went was always to the Jewish synagogue. So he was Kaufman will say here, mentioned, the ripest fruits of the Jewish synagogues. They were well-versed in the Old Covenant. They knew that God was going to have a Messiah come sometime in the Roman Empire, knowing that from the book of Daniel and Daniel's prophecies. And we know from early on in the book of Luke, that there were people that were waiting for God's kingdom. And we even found other places in the accounts of the gospel that there were individuals who were waiting on the kingdom of God. They knew that it was at hand. And anyway, these people just had not heard about Jesus being the Messiah. You know, being so far away from Jerusalem, living here, and maybe they hadn't made it to Jerusalem, or whatever they may have heard about Jesus being the Messiah, or someone that claimed to be the Messiah, and then maybe the Jews said no, that he was a false Messiah, and so just convinced them, and they just brushed it off. Okay, that was just a false Messiah, because there were quite a few false messiahs through the time that would try to deceive the people. But anyway, they were welcome and ready when Paul came to these Jewish synagogues. There were individuals, since we're talking about elders, there were men that were waiting on God's kingdom, and when they hear the good news of the plan of salvation, that is all the additional wisdom that they needed to become elders. And so they were not novices in that sense. Any questions or comments on anything about this? Okay, Kaufman continues here. They were not novices in the sense of being newly turned away from wickedness. Cornelius the centurion is an example of a Gentile convert who was not newly turned away from wickedness. And Nathanael is a Jewish example. Jesus stated about Nathanael, "Behold an Israelite indeed, in whom is no deceit." So Kaufman just gives two examples of people before they were Christians that were not novices when it came to being turned away from wickedness. So none of these that Paul appointed as elders were just fresh out of paganism and idolatry. Those are not the ones. These were devout Jews or Jewish proselytes, Jewish converts, who were well-educated in the Old Covenant and about the prophecies of the coming of the Messiah and the establishment of his kingdom. And they were waiting for that. The New Testament does not bind upon Christians any certain method of appointing either elders or deacons. It was Paul who appointed the elders in these congregations, and it would be a mistake to suppose that he yielded the right of choice to ignorant Gentile congregations whom he described as weak, base, despised, and foolish. Without taking the utmost precautions and providing firm guidance for them. So he provided firm guidance and principles to guide them that they were commanded to follow. And so Kaufman said, any method of appointing elders which promotes unity and does not violate any of these principles that Paul laid down through the Holy Spirit, of course, may be used. Okay. And then there are three Greek words in the New Testament which refer to the office of an elder. And those Greek words are bishop, presbyter, and pastor. And they get translated in most of our translations as overseer for bishop, elder for presbyter, and shepherd for pastor. So any of these six words with the additional term, furthermore, the term stewards is associated with this same office in the New Testament. So there are six words. Three of them are Greek words, and then these other four are English translations of the words. But bishop, presbyter, pastor, overseer, elder, shepherd, and stewards. All seven of those words are synonyms and used interchangeably. But Kaufman threw in here about stewards. Also, Paul said, the bishop must be blameless as God's steward in Titus 1:7. So these seven words are all synonyms and used interchangeably throughout the New Testament. Okay, any questions or comments on anything about elders? Yes. Yes, because that's where they lived. And then they came to Jerusalem. Right. That's right. And then they just had not heard of the plan of salvation and how to enter God's kingdom. And so when Paul brought that message to them, well, then that's all that they needed there. And they were already devout and following the old covenant as the Jews had been for some 1,500 years before.
It might seem like I think that the apostles could give certain talents to people when they couldn't go any further, but the apostles had the ability to translate, or so they could maybe give them knowledge beyond the normal understanding because the apostles could do that.
Spiritual gifts. Yes, and by the laying on of the apostles' hands, God would give then those individuals different spiritual gifts. In 1 Corinthians 12, Paul lays out 12 of them, that of these spiritual gifts, or nine. It's nine spiritual gifts. Now, there is no mention of Paul laying hands on any of these in here and giving them miraculous gifts. Now, there is in Acts chapter 19. There's a group of men, and that is the first mention of that he did such a thing. Now, what spiritual gift that God gave them through the laying on of Paul's hands in that instance was that they could speak in languages that they had not learned. Okay. Okay, but that's not what, this was over years. Here, this was 3.5+ years that Paul was spending with these congregations. This was daily teaching that he was teaching these places through these years in this time frame. And so in each place, it was, weeks and months, but from the time he was, from Antioch to Derbe, and by the time he got back, it was, 2 or 3 years. Well, as Kaufman said here, that they had been a few years already Christians. Yes, that right. Now, and then that's another thing about Luke here. And Kaufman mentions that from time to time, the brevity of Luke. He will just write a few words or a sentence or two that will cover a lot of material. So he doesn't give us many details, but it's a lot of time that Paul is spending daily with these people over weeks, months, and then ultimately about 3.5, it's the better part of 5 years. Now that's also going to be part of the time that he's spending here at Antioch. But anyway, the best number that I think I've gotten is about 3.5 years that he was here teaching with them. And you know, it was daily. It wasn't like once a week, a few minutes or hours a week. This was daily. And it was, Paul, we know that he would have been putting in 10, 12, 16, 18 hour days teaching every day to these people. You know, and everyone who is receptive to the good news of God's kingdom. Okay, we will, verses 24 and 25. And after they had passed through Pisidia, they came to Pamphylia. Okay, so now they are... he has already appointed elders in the congregations that he'd just gone through, Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch of Pisidia. So now he's out of this region of Pisidia. They're going back home. Well, I say home, back to the home congregation here, Antioch, that sent them on this first missionary journey. And so they come to Pamphylia. And now when they had preached the word in Perga, they went down to Attalia. So they go to Pamphylia and then to Perga, which is where they landed from Cyprus. They went to Perga the last time, and that's where they went again this time. And anyway, I'll read what Kaufman's comment is here. The apostles began to retrace their steps to Perga, where they first landed in their trip from Cyprus. The year was probably 48 AD, and certainly in the summer season. They returned through Pamphylia to Syrian Antioch. Luke tells us nothing of the success of the missionaries in Perga, only that they spoke the word of the gospel there. We are not told the reason for Paul's move from Perga to Attalia. It is probable that he was unable to get a vessel bound for Antioch from the port of Perga. Therefore, he traveled by land to the seaport at Attalia. And Attalia is on the coast of Pamphylia, 16 miles from Perga. So, we are not told by Luke why they went from the port city of Perga, and instead of getting in a boat there and going to Antioch, they travel 16 miles west and go to the next port city to the west, Attalia, and that's where they get on a boat and go back to Antioch. But Kaufman's suspected that they were not able to find a boat or a ship. Maybe they didn't have one at port that was going back to Antioch. Well, actually, it'd be to Seleucia. That was the port city that they would land at, and it wasn't one headed that way. And so then they went west to Attalia, hoping that they would be able to, and then they were able to catch a boat from there and head back. So any questions or comments on any of this?